the largest faculty in the city, about 20 members of the BTF, Buffalo Teachers Federation, about 20 members of the Buffalo Federation of Teachers, which was the AFT affiliate, and everybody else is a non-member. And they all say that Hobart got transferred to this school to organize this. You know, that's what he's going to be doing here. Well, I didn't make time to organize this building. I've got a full-time job there, and I'm out in the other 99 buildings that are around the city. And so anyway, I get my 20 members together, and I say, well, you know, the principal is really giving us a hard time. We've got a right to meet with him with all the grievances. And I got all these grievances. They said, well, they're from non-members. I said, well, you know, we've got to take care of non-members too. I said, so who's going to go in with me? So it was two people finally agreed to go in with me. So got the date to go in there. And there's a principal sitting there. And behind him are about 9 or 10 people. We say in his advisory committee, they're all my members. Every one of them. And whatever I say, and we want this, he sits there, he turns around, and he says, and what is the advisory committee's decision? And they'll say yes or no. Whatever they said, he goes yes or no. So, we got nothing. So everything went to the third level grievance. We're going to make a thing out of this committee. But then we go to it to the next level, and we win everything. And this guy got madder. And then I'm on these long phone calls, September rolls around, and the assistant principal says he's quit. So he's getting to school like at 6 o'clock in the morning because I'm trying to get in to see him. You know, before he goes into his office, locks the door, won't answer the door. You know, he's in there and he stays there. And I stay late at night and never can get to see this guy. And there's going to be an election in the city of Buffalo for the at-large members of the common council. There's 4 at-large members, and I think there were 12 districts that were there. And it just so happened that 3 of the at-large are up for election that year. And I become the issue in the 3 campaigns. Some of them support me. Some of them support the principal. And Daddy's mother, who lives in the school district, you know, calls up and says, what the hell did you do? So about three teachers wrote letters saying what a bad guidance counselor I was. And they were the worst teachers in the building. And they all say, the German teacher said, advising everybody against going into German. Well, the truth was that I couldn't get kids. You know, there were very few kids going to college out of this. There was like 2,500 there. We had 50 kids that indicated any interest in the senior class of post-secondary education. And the few that wanted science backgrounds, I wanted to take German because at that time there were a lot of the technical manuals that were in German, and it was a good background to have. Kids would not go into this guy's class. And so he writes bad guidance counselor, disruptive force. They all use the word disruptive force. So principal's saying, all right, I'm going to transfer you to this school. I'm not going to take a transfer. Yes, you are. I got to get you out of there. You won't have to come to school. You can take care of your state work. You don't have to come to school at all. I'll transfer you to City Hall. I'll make you my assistant. You don't have to come to work. You know, I said, no, you're not transferring me out of here. I'm staying here. So finally, he calls and he says, report to my office tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. I said, can't. I got appointments with kids. I'm giving you a direct order. You appear in my office 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Not my office. You appear in the Associate Superintendent for Instruction's office at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. That's an order. Insubordination if you don't show up. So 9 o'clock in the morning, down I go. I get there and the secretary goes, he's been in there for an hour. I said, who? Your principal. God, he's been there for an hour. So the assistant superintendent for instruction had been the assistant principal at the first school I'd been at. And he'd moved up the ranks. He ended up superintendent. He ended up being consultants all over the country. He was really a great guy. This is his first month on the job as the associate superintendent for instruction. So the door opens and he comes out and he goes, I can't tell you what happened, but come on to my office. So in I go, and the principal goes, Tom, how are you? He said, puts his arm around me. He said, I'm so glad we settled this. He said, I want you to know I think you do a great job as a guidance counselor. He said, but the issue was whether I would be backed up or not. And I had to use you as the issue because you were the highest profile for me to say that if I wanted you transferred, I would be backed up. And as soon as he said he would transfer you, I told him I want to keep you. He goes, now, I'm going to go back and have a faculty meeting and explain this to the faculty. He said, so you take the rest of the day off. So he leaves, and I say to the associate, I say, what the hell happened? I said, just like he said. He said, I finally said to him, okay, we'll transfer. This guy had a history of, at that point, we have a lot of what was called permanent substitutes.
Yeah.
In our case, the permanent substitutes were people who had graduated from a normal school, 2 years degree. Mm-hmm. When Buffalo accepted that for certification, Buffalo was its own certifying agent. And there were three certifying agents in the states, New York City, Buffalo, and the state. So Buffalo used to accept those as fully certified people. Most of them were women who left to for maternity leave. There wasn't a maternity leave, who left to have a baby.
Right.
When they came back, the state had imposed the state certifying standards on the city. And so they never could become a certified teacher. So as a substitute, as a permanent substitute, and they hire you, you know, for a full year as a permanent substitute, could be dismissed on 24 hours notice. And he would keep half of his faculty as permanent substitutes. And he would transfer these people out every year to make sure he kept that balance.
Uh-huh.
And he had these few people that were his advisory committee that had tenure, and all these people that didn't have tenure. So that's what he said. And I said to my friends when I went back, the few that I had at school, you know, what happened? He said there wasn't a sound in the faculty meeting. Because he told them exactly what he had told me. And he said, especially these people who wrote the letters about you, they were like crawling under the table. So later on, I figured out what it was. That he had assumed that I was going to be elected president of NYSTA in November, and I'd be gone. This was the end of September.
Mm-hmm.
And so he only had to put up with me for 6 or 7 weeks. But this was an iron principle. Daddy had him as a history teacher, an iron person. And it destroyed him. He retired in the middle of that spring semester. And he left.
Really?
Left, yeah.
Huh.
So, anyway, I was out of South Park, and we were on the merger talks, and Tony and Ed comes running down the hall, and they see me, and I'd say, yeah, what's going on? And they said, you betrayed us. What the hell did I do? I said, the meeting's going to be at the Fort Orange Club.
The Fort Orange Club?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, so what? Fort Orange Club doesn't allow women inside on the property. Obviously, Tony can't go to the meeting at the Fort Orange Club. So now I go to see Frank, say, Frank, what the hell are you doing down there? He goes, oh, I never thought of that. I said, well, then just change the meeting. Oh, no, I can't do that. I said, Frank, I'll change the meeting. I'll call Shanker. I'll set up a place. I'll find a place that we're going to... No. I do all the arranging of places, you know. So the meeting was moved over to the university club. And so Tony and Ed came. And before each of the meetings, Ned Hopkins would sit down with us and we would work out the break-off news release.
Okay.
And, you know, good intentions at your meeting. You got your break-off press release already there. So we met with Al. That's the first time I met Al. First time I met Sandy.
So this is the first time you meet the radical New York City UFT people.
Well, you know, to me, you know, coming out of Buffalo, Al was a hero. You know, I, you know, Jesus, that's, we wanted to collect a bargain like Allied, you know? I know him, but we came close at a collective bargain election in Niagara Falls. He was there before I got there and had left already, you know, but I just had never met him. So we had the first meeting, and...
Who else was there? There was Dan Sanders...
Walter Tice, Abel Blattman, Sandy Feldman, Ken Deedy, and Al.
Okay.
I don't think there's any staff there. I guess Sandy was staff.
Sandy was staff.
Yeah. On our side, it was Tony, Ed, and I, Frank White, Ned Hopkins, and Fred Lambert. Now, Rand Lambert, it turned out, had written the doctoral thesis for White in Massachusetts at Harvard, whose topic was the merger talks in Massachusetts, which Al headed for Selden. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, White was a phony. He didn't write his own dissertation. And he had Lambert there again, and later on, you know, Fred was a good friend of Frank's, and he never would admit it, but he was always very sheepish about it, so I assumed it was correct. He had Lambert there to write a book on merger, which White would put his name on. And so...
Good guy.
So we started out there, and it didn't... And we didn't get very far. AFL-CIO was a problem. How we, the president related to his staff was a problem. You know, all the normal problems were there at the first meeting. So we had another meeting. I don't know how many went on, but we finally had one at a place called Motel on the Mountain.
I got a dentist appointment.
Okay.
See
you. Yep, see you later. Alan said they had a good chef at Motel on the Mountain.
I don't even know.
So we got there. You know where it is? It's, you know, it's as you come up from New York City, it's I think it's in Westchester County, but the northern part of Westchester County. It's a big turn on the thruway, and you see this place up on the hill, you know, that's there. So the chef was in Europe, so the meals were shitty. And when I took a shower in the morning, it looked like there was a light in the drain in the bathtub. So, you know, after I got out, I bent over to see what it was. Well, there wasn't any drain. It drained out onto the mountain. There was sunlight that was coming in. So,
nice place.
So we moved to Arden House. You know what Arden House is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well. But what was significant about this meeting is that in the middle of the meeting, White got a call from his family. I think his uncle, or a very close uncle, had died in Massachusetts. And he excused himself. So the important part wasn't that we moved from Motel on the Mountain to the Arden House, but that White left, because White was an obstructionist. You know, he would interrupt. You know, if we started going off, he'd be off onto a tangent. You know, it was obviously he was there to prevent this from happening. And so White left, and... that's the first day, and so we're there for the night, and there isn't anything to do there. They brought in a bartender, so we were all at the bar. So, you know, we get to know Tice and Deedy and Feldman. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, as Tice always used to say to the NEA people, I'm like a field, no horns, you know. And we got along pretty good. We went over to the Arden House, and we made a lot of progress. You know, things were starting to really, really come together. So a couple more meetings, White was there. At one of them, White threatened to sue us.
Sue us.
The association.
The association board. Yeah.
Officers. Because he said we were negotiating away his constitutional powers. So Rogers had said, well, okay, Frank, sue us. We'll see you in court. You probably shouldn't work for us while you're suing us. So White got all flustered. But I took it more seriously. You know, I felt that, you know, I should protect the organization against even frivolous suits. And I read the Constitution pretty closely. there was the normal, you know, in the association, only the president had about four responsibilities: chair the convention and be the spokesman. You know, there were a few things that the president, and the executive secretary used to have two pages.
Jeez.
You know, hire the staff, fire the staff, negotiate with the staff, direct the staff, you know, very specific. And White had all of those in there. And one difference in NYSTA was one of the powers of the president was to be the chief executive officer. And NYSTA also did not have a term limit. Well, that's wrong. NYSTA had a term limit because I'd been chairman of the Constitutional Revision Committee, and I won on every issue, which really converted us into a union-type organization, including this the chief executive officer. And the one thing I lost on was term limits. Mm-hmm. So I just went into a fight. I said, look, go call your lawyer. I'm the chief executive officer. You work for me. And he said, no, he didn't. And it had come to a head because we were moving from the building that we owned to a rental building. And on his recommendation, and the board had only agreed to do it if we reduced the costs of occupancy. And I knew we were running way over costs. He had not figured in the moving costs. The renovation of the building was costing a lot more. I mean, it was just going sky high. And there was always a debate over whose office we'd go to, his or mine. You know, obviously, you have to come to my office because, you know, I'm waiting for a call from the governor, I'm waiting for a call from the commissioner. I say, Frank, that's bullshit. You know, I'm in your office a lot. You never get a call from any of these people. Now they're calling you. The only calls he ever got from his wife, which was always a huge fight, which I would have thought, you know, he wouldn't want somebody in his office while this is happening. And, you know, he'd just soon be in my office. He'd go back to his office being in private. But anyway, that was, and so it wasn't that big of a thing for me. I mean, I was going to do it just over the you know, the principle of the thing, because I didn't really have anything to do as president. Nothing to do. And he was always very upset with me because, you know, my plane got in from Buffalo about 7 in the morning. So I was down there at 7:30. By 9 o'clock, when the staff started coming, I was bored stiff. You know, I'd done everything possible that you could do. I'd walk around and talk to the staff. So he had come to my office once to say how disrupting this was. You know, the staff didn't know whether to answer my questions or not. You know.
Jeez.
So he's in on the phone with his wife, arguing with his wife. I got nothing to do. He's got no magazines or newspapers or books on the shelf. You know, it's all knickknacks and nothing to do there. I'm walking around. Behind his bookcase, there is a parcel board. And I pull it out. I turn around and look at it. It says, designer's concept for Dr. White's office. I said, he hangs up. I said, what's this? He said, well, that's personal. I prefer if you not go through my personal things. I said, Frank, it says office. What the hell is this? Well, my office has to be as nice as the Commissioner of Education. I said, cancel it.
Yeah.
I said, you're way over budget. I was going to have your office done too. I said, Frank, cancel them both. We're way over budget. Well, you can't tell me to do that. I said, well, I'm the chief executive officer. I'm telling you, cancel it. I said, the next thing I'll do is I'll call the sheriff and have you put out of the office. Mm. So he said, I demand a meeting of the board. So I call a special meeting of the board. I knew it was going to be a disaster because they hated
me. Oh, okay.
I mean, the one reason the board supported me over Paul and Carl Hedstrom was they thought Paul and Carl Hedstrom wanted to be NEA president and that they would be gone all the time and Frank would be left to run the organization. And they supported me because they thought I'd keep Frank in line. And I was going to live up to that responsibility because I was going to keep Frank in line whether they wanted it or not. So we get the special board meeting up in Glens Falls. And so one of the board members says, well, why are we here? What's this special board meeting? And I said, well, this is the situation. We're way over budget on the on the move from what the board authorized. Frank had this interior decorator going to his office. I have ordered him to cancel it. He says I don't have the power to cancel it. And Frank wanted a special board meeting. That's why we're here. Frank?
Yep.
So Frank said, well, you know, this I have these constitutional powers, and you know, I'm going to go through all this bullshit, you know, and they're like steaming out there. So Cyril Matarazzo, one of the board members, raised his hand and said, so Frank, if you don't work for the president, who do you work for? You work for the board? And White says, no, I do not work for the board. I work for the members. So Cyril says, well, can you then tell us, well, what is the role of the board in your employment? He said, well, when my contract comes to an end, shortly before that, the board will decide on the conditions for an extension of that contract or not. But once you decide on that, then I work for the members.
Interesting.
There are some other questions in there, but really that question is really what set the stage. So in a reception, I don't know if it was a formal reception or just some guys came up to my room afterwards and I was drinking there. And so the board members are saying, we're pissed at you. You made us come all the way up here. You should have fired that bastard. So that really set the stage for it. We'd come across some information that we had rental cars in two separate cities on the same day that he had reimbursed himself for as an organizational expense. It was the only thing he ever did for himself. He used to fill out his own voucher and carry it down to finance and stand there and wait while they cut the check. He would leave with the check. Everything else the secretary did. And so we had this, and so I said, well, Frank, we're going to fire you. And he said, well, I demand to meet with the immediate past president. I said, sure. I mean, I'm not going to argue over that. So I get Manny to come in, and Manny Gaffigan's there. And I think Frank thought that Manny would support him on whatever he wanted to do. And so Frank came in with a briefcase, and I said, Manny, what do you think of this? Manny said, it's obvious. The board wants you fired. And he walked out. So the meeting lasted like 4 minutes, five minutes. He was gone. So his attorney contacted us, and we had an attorney sit down with him. Rogers and I were sitting in a meeting and waiting for the attorney. Attorney came in, and he goes, you caught this guy on something big. I said, oh, you mean on the cars? He goes, oh, that's bullshit. He said, you're going to get a jury of traveling salesmen. They're going to laugh you right out of court. But you caught him on something big. We'll never know what it is. But you caught him on something big, because he's got an ironclad contract. I think he had 17 months left on his 3-year contract. He had like 25 months left on his 3-year contract, and he's willing to settle for 17 months. And so and the other condition was that he'd be able to come and go from his office for the next 2 weeks. This was St. Patrick's Day. We were moving to the new building on the 1st of April. He wanted to be able to come in until whatever the Friday was before the 1st of April.
Right.
So we accepted it. And he was gone. Tony Cortese said to me afterwards, she says, who lost? We're sending his check to some beach in Portugal. Who lost on this? next board meeting, the board said, well, who's going to assume his responsibilities? I said, well, you know, we've already established that I'm the guy that oversees the organization. I said, I will. The 1st of April also was the first day of the merger, and the board took a position that before the merger came about, that we were to hire a new executive secretary, because the board wanted an executive secretary in place before the merger occurred, so that this will be the highest staff person in the new merged organization. So one of the guys that was very responsible for the merger was Dean Strife. He was one of the assistant executive secretaries for field services. He had replaced Lambert. The other guy on our side was Ken Law. He was a longtime NEA staff guy. He'd gotten him from Connecticut. Dean had replaced those two. And Dean was the one that came up with the idea that the difference between the AFT and the NEA dues, the NEA charged $25, the AFT charged $18. And how are we going to pay this dues? You know, the members, the NYSTA members would get an $18 dues increase, the AFT members would get a $25 dues increase. This was a hell of a whack when we didn't know. There was no agency fee. We didn't know if we have any members that would do embrace this. So Dean came up with the idea that we would pay the national dues out of the state treasury. Because Dean said that we would have a great increase in membership. I said, Dean, you're smoking something, you know, right? I'm hoping we get Al had 85,000, we had 105,000. I was just hoping for 190,000, you know. Dean says, increase in membership. Dean said, but Dean had the vision, and so we got the board to accept all of that. I wanted Dean to be the executive secretary. Mm-hmm. And the board evidently felt that Dean was too close to me, and what I was finding out, that they had supported me on one issue only. That was getting rid of Frank.
Get rid of Frank.
Once Frank was gone,
they didn't want you.
They bailed out. I mean, they were gone. So we did a survey around of the board members, and we did not have a majority to elect Dean. Dean was very, very disappointed. So Tony and Ed and I got together and said, you know, what the hell are we going to do? You know, we don't want, and we can screw up this merger. You know, because the intent, obviously, is to prevent this from taking off. And we'd gotten to know some of Al's staff. And I had an idea. I said, what about Vito? I said, they'll never accept Vito. I said, but how are they going to turn him down? You know, he's a director of staff at the U of T. He's got the experience. And he's one of us. How are they going to turn him down? Al's not recommending him. I'm recommending him. You know, how can they do it? So Tony and Ed said, well, let's try it. So we called up Vito. Vito said, buddy, are you fucking mine? Said, it means you got to work in Albany. I ain't working in Albany. I work down here. He said, no, I ain't going to work in Albany. And so we said, well, let's try it. So we go to the board meeting. And this is the board meeting where they want to fire Hopkins.
Okay.
They had found out that at the vote for merger, that Hopkins had printed material about things the board had done that would have been helpful in breaking up the NYSET membership, you know, allowing Utney to organize. I didn't tell you about the convention. We had to get a vote of the delegates on this merger. Once we had signed it,
then you have to go to...
Right, have to go to the board. Board turns it down 31-4. Two of the four I absolutely know are Tony Cortez and Ed Rogers.
Yeah.
Those are two. I'm certain about a guy, Dave Whitelaw, who was from my area. I'm certain that he was there. And I'm 99% sure about a guy named Doug Matusik from Syracuse was there. And there was a guy, Bill Sweet, that always started off every speech he had by, I was one of the ones that voted for merger.
Okay.
I remember him on the other side. But anyway, I never challenged Bill on that. But it was 31-4. We got killed. The other conspirator was Clyde Cook, who was our treasurer, who was going to meet with us to help us prepare how to influence the board. We never could find him. We found he moved over to the other side. So.
Oh, he was supposed to meet with you like that day or the morning or that night?
And he went to the other side.
Ooh, so nice.
So the meeting is going to be like a disaster. We'd invited Al up to talk. You know, Al's out in the hallway, you know, as I'm getting killed. Now, I often wondered why Al took a chance on us, because in that election, which had been in November, we're now in April, you know, we're only 5 months away, only Ed had won on the first ballot, and that was challenged because he didn't get the Constitution said a majority of the ballots cast. He didn't get a majority of all of those voting. He got a majority of the ballots cast, but not
voting.
You know, he like won by six. There were a lot of people that abstained. And so Ed went on the first ballot. Tony and I went to a second ballot. So 5 months later, Al's putting his faith in three people who maybe can't bring anybody with them, or, you know, a bare majority they can bring with them, maybe. So Al's out in the hall, and we're getting our ass kicked. And so it ends, and I said, well, you know, Al's out in the hall. He's going to talk to us. I said, well, if he's invited up there, you know, we're polite people. We'll listen to him. And I said, no, I invited him to the special convention. He's going to vote on us. So now, I told you about the year before, we had this big thing about who invites people to the convention.
Right.
So these guys, some of them my friends, some of them of these eight that I've been conspiring with in the old organization, they're pretty sharp people. Been established, you can invite whoever you want. But we would advise you to be very careful on who you would.
He does a good job talking, but doesn't change any minds at all.
And they're like, they've had two or three meetings and they're tight.
Right.
So now they also say that the officers can't, they're not going to let the officers go out and try to sell this merger.
Is this how they're slowing down the merger? That's the board. Did they want the merger to happen?
Evidently not.
Yeah.
You know, it was merger, but not at any cost.
Right.
So they elected an executive committee on their initiative. The purpose of the executive committee is to ensure the officers don't sell this merger.
That's the slowdown. Yeah.
And to ensure they don't use the periodicals of the association to sell this merger. So
you could not use the Challenger.
Right.
You could not. Could you use stationery?
No.
Nothing.
Nothing. So we walk out. Tony and Ed are furious with me. How dare you agree to that? I said, well, we signed the merger agreement, right? They're going to publicize that we signed a merger agreement. Let's see what will happen. You threw this whole thing away. Say, well, let's see what happens. So we go to to the conventions at the Concord. And Catherine Barrett notifies us she will be there. She's now president of the NEA.
Is this before that article came out, the interview with you that you never gave?
That was during the merger discussions that came up. Ned wrote that. I got a call from Catherine's office about summonsing me to Washington. I think the only time that the NEA ever summoned a state president. You know, state president's a really higher level than that. But I got summoned to Washington. Charles, the chauffeur, met me with the NEA Cadillac at the airport, told me to the meeting. She and Terry Hernan said, admit it, Ned wrote this. I said, well, you know, he's the assistant executive secretary for communication. You know, he helped. No, Ned did this. You didn't know anything about this. Are you saying I don't know what goes on in my organization? You're not, you did this, he didn't do this. Yes. So Tony and Ed were like very pleased with it, because they had thought it was bullshit to be arguing about the AFL-CIO. And I had said to him, are you kidding? You know, that's our biggest lever on hell. When we give on that, we get everything else we want. We're not going to give that up. Now, originally I had been anti-union. You know, I got started with the Buffalo Teachers Federation. There were three organizations: high school organization, the elementary school teachers, and the Buffalo Teachers Federation. Mm-hmm. I said very simply, the high school teachers and the elementary teachers, they don't organize everybody. And the Buffalo Teachers Federation does. The Buffalo Federation of Teachers, the AFL-CIO affiliate, doesn't even have an office. Buffalo Teachers Federation has a printing machine. That's where I'm going. Yeah. But I was always opposed to the word union. I accepted the professionalism idea. And one day my mom, who's, my mom was a great lady, but she wasn't really astute politically. You know, she says to me, what's your union doing today? Wait a minute, I got to take this from the editorial writers at the Buffalo Evening News, because they tell me union is shorter than trying to explain what an association is.
Yeah,
But I don't have to take this from you, Mom. And so she goes over, opens up a dictionary, and she says, well, Webster says that a union fights for better benefits for its members and to protect their rights. What is it that you do? So I thought, well, I guess I better accept this, you know. But Catherine...
So she summons you down to D.C.?
Yeah, down to D.C., get this interrogation. She's very unhappy when I say, is Charles going to drive me back to the airport? She says, no. So I didn't get a ride back to the airport with Charles. And so she says she's coming to the convention. Now, Catherine, in my opinion, was an outstanding politician. I told you that she ran in the campaign that shouldn't be an administrator, and she didn't believe that. I mean, she was just an astute politician. She had a low Greta Garbo type voice. She spun magic when she talked to people. And she got all the way to NEA president. So, I mean, she was good. So, figured that's going to be a problem. So we get to the convention, and you know, we've been going all over the state, and people have been saying, is it true the officers have been gagged? I said, no, not true. Well, tell us about this. I said, I'll answer any questions that you have about it. Well, what do you think of it? I'd say, I signed the agreement, I negotiated it. Oh, well, then they ask me questions. You know, but we've been going all around the state, and that appeared to be going, you know, fairly well.
Yeah.
So I was confident going into the meeting, because I'm confident going into every meeting. I'm probably overconfident, and I've been very fortunate that I haven't had some of these meetings backfire on me. But we went into the meeting. Catherine's going to be there. I'm willing to take Catherine on, see what happens. At breakfast, Ned Hopkins says to me, I've gotten Paul Cole to make the motion to accept the merger. Now, Paul had been Catherine's campaign manager.
Yeah, and he ran against you. And
ran against me. Said, are you sure? He goes, yeah, call on him first. So, get up there. People run to the microphones. I call on microphone one. Paul's smart enough to go to microphone one. When Paul moves for the merger, the place is stunned. They're assuming Paul's leader against the merger.
Sure. So
Paul moves up. The second lady... I was very happy not to call on her first. So Lorraine, it's 30 years ago. I missed her name. Maybe Paul knows her name. But anyway, she gets up and she says, why is the board of directors against this merger? So I respond, I got the faintest idea. Why don't we ask the board members to come up and tell you? So Antonia says, what are you, crazy, giving him the microphone? One thing we got is the microphone, you're giving it away. So the first guy to come up was Umberto Colon, Herb Colon. So Umberto comes up, And Umberto says, we told Tom that he could not have a board any bigger than 50, and he let us down. So Umberto starts to leave. I say, hey, Herb, how big is the board? So Herb says, 53. So laughter out in the audience.
Yeah, right, right.
So the next one to come up is Tom Pisa. He's the guy that's replaced me as president of Buffalo Teachers Federation. And he's leading the opposition, I guess. If Paul wasn't, Tom was. And so he comes up and he says, I'm opposed to this merger because it allows the president to have assistants, and that will make him too powerful. So he starts to walk away. I said, Tom, by the way, what was your position when I was president of the Buffalo Teachers Federation? So he comes back. He says, I was your assistant.
More chuckling in the audience,
you know. And so four or five of them come up and they start doing this. And one is worse than the other. I mean, one lady come up about some little thing, some word. The word shouldn't have been, it should have been may and not shall, or, you know, some little thing. And so now, any other board members? No more board members. How about people in the audience? You know, let's go back to the debate. So some guy gets up and he said, I demand that we not vote until we hear from Catherine Baer. So I say, I agree with you. So Antonia says, there you go, you can win it now. So, by the way, Tony, for 30 years, is my strongest supporter. And except for these couple of things, she was normally right, and I was wrong, and there was a difference of opinion. But I always felt very comfortable running meetings. And I said, well, I'll show you, we're going to talk to Catherine. So I sent a couple of people up to her room to tell her to come down right away. So as the people are debating, there's one guy in the front row, I don't know if you ever were in the great room at the Concord, when they'd set it up for the comedians to come in and all that, it was a round stage, and they would, the front tables would elongate into the stage, so that the front row tables would have 20 people at it sitting this way. So it was one of the guys that was, you know, right at the first seat at the table was heckling me like the whole convention, and all these comments, you know, which were uncomplimentary. So people come back, they say, she won't answer her phone and she won't answer the door. We know she's in there. So the debate goes on for a while, and I said, well, just keep somebody out there, keep somebody knocking on the door, tell her I want her down here as soon as possible. You know, this thing is ready to vote. I want to vote as soon as possible. And so somebody rises and they said, well, I move to close debate and move to a vote. I said, well, you can't. I'm ruling you out of order. I've told the body that we won't vote to hear from Catherine. We got our national president here. We're going to hear from her before we vote. So whoever this guy was said, well, I challenge ruling the chair. I know I've got a privileged motion here, and I want to vote on it. I said, well, my reasons is I've told the body that we won't vote till Catherine comes down. Let's go to a vote. All those who support the chair, stand. Man, I got crushed. Can't anybody standing. So sit down. All those that oppose the chair, stand. Like the whole place stands up. I mean, oh, well, yeah, you know, at least nobody's going to, you know, challenge that to do this. But this Catherine comes in the back of the hall, starts walking down the aisle. All these people standing must have been struck with embarrassment because they start to applaud. As they applaud, her smile gets bigger and bigger and bigger. She comes down the aisle, she comes up to the stage. I introduce her, the president of the National Education Society, Catherine C. Baer, former president of NYSED. She walks up there, she says, I've always appreciated this gathering of delegates, and I know you'll do the right thing. My only word to you is move carefully and make sure the decision you make is the right decision. Thank you for having me. And this guy that's been heckling me all the while says, well, Tom, if Catherine's for it, I guess I'm for it. And we had the vote, and I'm telling you, it was overwhelming.
Yeah.
Overwhelming. So, you know, the merger was in place.
Jeez. All in about 6 or 7 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing.
So, the first joint board meeting is going to be, the merger agreement said that we would be merged on April 1st, and the merger will take effect April 1st, and we'll be merged in all aspects of organizational operations by May 1st, 1973. We've debated that language over the years, so what the hell that means. And the NYSET conventions are one short, because the lady that was in charge of the conventions before Biffero didn't count the first one. And so I served 34 years as president, and I was at the 33rd convention. The first board meeting was going to be in August. I was going to the WCOTP meeting, which is World Confederation of Organizations of the Teaching Profession. And so I had left Tony and Ed in charge of putting together the first budget. So I called the NYSET Executive Committee together, and I said to them, what are the important things? You know, I'll make sure that Ed and Tony get the important, whatever you guys think is important. If we have an agreement on it, I'll make sure that we get those things. And one of them, I don't remember which one, said, we want Utney stipend.
Oh,
Al paid the vice presidents $1,000 a year.
On stipend.
Stipend.
Yeah.
And I said, and anything else? They said no, which, as far as I was concerned, was golden. I mean, if they wanted creature comforts over member needs, I mean, that's blackmail, 101. So I told Tony and Ed, I said, put this all together. We're going to have a board meeting in August, and it's got to be accepted by both sides. Make sure that, Utney says that they can deliver on what they agreed to. So I went off to London, and when I came back, we had the board meeting, and I presented, I'm missing one. We had one board meeting before that, and that's where I presented Vito's name as the executive secretary.
Okay.
And it was either the recommendation of Vito that caught them off guard, or the fact that we made the recommendation at all that caught them off guard, because there wasn't any opposition to Vito. And so Vito got up and said, I want you to know that I don't accept any of this bullshit in the Constitution. I work for the president. Al was satisfied that we would have a structure. Al was willing to work with whatever we came up to in the end. He said, look, if there's certain things we need in order to get the upstate people to join, we're going to do them. But at the first convention, I'm going to overturn them, like we put term limits in. Because I said, look, Al, I just have no credibility at all if the only thing I didn't get as chairman of the Constitutional Revision Committee is no term limits. And we have a merger, and I come back with no term limits. Mm-hmm. So Al said, well, will you work with me at the next convention to do it? I said, yeah, I'll tell people up front, that rather than a majority vote, that I'm going to take it to a two-thirds vote in order to have no term limits. And Al said, well, so am I. So, and I had said to Al, yeah, when you go upstage, you can't say union. Don't say union. So Al said, okay, it's good advice, it's all right. Well, you won't use union. Can I talk about other unions? I go, yeah, you can talk about other unions. Don't call this one union. And so the board came together. We had devised a voting situation where Al had 50 vice presidents on the executive council, and had 85,000 members, and we had 35 members on our board of directors, and we had 105,000 members. So the breakdown was that every NYSTA board member got 1.5 votes, and every Utney vice president, got 0.9 votes. And we gave them signs, and, you know, I should remember, but one was a red sign and one was a green sign.
Okay.
And we had a counter, an official counter, and they would put up the signs and somebody would count and use a calculator, tell us what the vote was. By the second or third meeting, we had people trading signs, you know, two green signs for a red sign, and, you know, like, back and forth. So the boards came together without any difficulty. Staff was...
Was this because they realized that we're all here together? We're here for the same issues, basically.
No, they get killed. I don't think they were altruistic at all. I think they counted the vote at the convention. It was so overwhelming. And by the way, after the convention voted, it had to go to a vote of the members.
Yeah.
And the vote of the members was 72,000 to 19,000 or something. So it was it was so overwhelming that I believe that that was their motive, that they were getting ahead of the race rather than doing it. And then the board changed very rapidly. Those that were militant on the board stayed, and those that weren't upbeat. And, you know, Utney people won these district races, and we had to compromise that there would be 35 districts elected in the districts, and there would be one at large for every two districts, and they would be elected at large.
Uh-huh.
And I think Al would have always said that the Utney people won more than their share of the district races, you know, where they were competing with the NYSDA people. So it was overwhelming, and while I held my breath, Dean had been absolutely right. We got 214,000 members the first year, because we had all those people that never joined before that were caught up in this merger idea. And so now we got to perform. You know, first thing coming for us is the Senate race in New York to replace don't remember who Moynihan replaced. There might have been Javits. No, it wasn't Javits. Might have been Keating. Or no, Buckley. It might have been Buckley. There was four candidates in the Democratic race: Bella Abzug, Ramsey Clark, Paul O'Dwyer, and Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Moynihan was seen as the least likely to get elected.
Moynihan was?
Yeah. Bella Abzug was by far the stronger candidate, since New York City votes in a larger proportion in the primary than the rest of the state. I think O'Dwyer, as a former mayor, was seen as, and I think Ramsey Clark was from New York, and so was Moynihan. Even though he said he had a farm in Delaware County, everybody thought he was from New York. You know, he talked about Hell's Angels and or Hell's Kitchen.
Hell's Kitchen. Yeah.
And Al liked Moynihan. I guess he knew he was going to be a social democrat someday. And, so we talked about it. Everybody agreed with Al. We had to kill Bella Abzug.
Too radical?
No, she broke open this school during the 68th strike.
That's right, she closed.
Yeah. And she would campaign about it. And I mean, she never repented for doing it. Always said it was the right thing to do. And so we knew we had to beat Bella. And I didn't know Ramsey Clark or Paul Dwyer at all. So Moynihan was okay with me. We had gotten pretty active in politics, but mostly in the Senate and the senatorial race, or assembly races in the state. We had not really done anything on high level. I'd been a co-chair for teachers from McGovern, but I got killed at the Political Action Committee. I had to resign from that. It was like, ugh. There was nobody from McGovern except me. I mean, it was. So we went with Moynihan, and You know, Al made the famous quip afterwards. He said, every race has to be like this. They have to win by less votes and we have members. And, you know, Moynihan went everywhere and said it was the teachers that were the reason he won the primary. And with a split in New York City, it's probably true. I mean, upstate had no reason to vote for Abzug, Clark, or O'Dwyer. I mean, they, or for Moynihan. I mean, it was they were you know, every political club around the state had a candidate, but, you know, they were ineffective. And so we got full credit for it. Whether it was deserved or not, we got full credit for Moynihan.
So this puts Nysett on the political map.
Right.
There you are.
Now, the next gubernatorial race is against Malcolm Wilson. Rockefeller is retired, invested the governorship in Malcolm Wilson, and we get called to Long Island to Joe Maggiato, who's the head of the Nassau County Republican Party. At that time, the top fundraiser in the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Maggiato was a assemblyman from Long Island, and our first attempt as an association in political action was to run a huge campaign against Milt Jonas. Nassau County Senator, who's chair of the Senate Education Committee. And Jonas wins 2-1. But he should have won 9-1. And Maggiato says that it's the most costly race he's ever run in Nassau County in order to beat the teachers. And that no teacher issue will get a Republican vote in the assembly. I'm not speaking for the Senate, but in the assembly. So Manny Kafka is one of our legislative reps. He's the past president of NYSTA. And Manny's from Long Island. Manny knows Maggiato. He knows Jonas. Tells me, he says, they won't let us in their office. So at that time, we were staying in a motel across the street from the, or down the street from the office building on Wolf Road. It was called the Round Towner. It's now a Sheridan. It has a swimming pool. And Ed Rogers, who's from Long Island, came to me and he said, Maggiato is meeting, having a staff meeting every morning in a pool. Said he won't meet with us. Manny said, we're not going to try to meet with him. Every morning we'd come down and we'd swim one lap in the pool. At the end of the lap, we'd say, good morning, Mr. Maggiato. He would go in and go about our day. Tell him, Ed, I said, this ain't working. Ed said, let's just keep doing it. Let's just keep doing it. One morning he said, good morning, Mr. Maggiato. And Joe says, good morning. Why don't you send somebody down to my office?
Nice.
So we gave him enough deference that he was going to work with us. And after that, I'll tell you, he was the best friend to have. He never voted with us on a damn thing, but we always got enough Republican votes to pass whatever the hell we wanted to pass.
Okay.
And we have a fly problem. I mean, I'd go after him, but. I make a mess in here.
That's okay. Yeah.
So we had started out on that. We started to fix things up. That race was a disaster. We had met with Stanley Steingut, who was the speaker in the assembly, before the races began, and Stanley had said, "Don't give any money to my guys." He said, "Please." He says, "Give the money to me." He said, "You're going to come to me to deliver votes. If you give the money to my guys are going to be independent of me. I can't deliver anything."
Sure.
So Manny and I went to the our first political action committee. Our group is called Vote, Voice of Teachers in Education. And so now we call it Vote Cope. So we have to combine the two.
Another merger.
Yeah. And we fought hard for that and finally won the issue. A very close call. We won that the money would be given to